Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys. I think this is the second time that I've spoken to you guys, but the first time was a few years ago. I spoke on a hoarseness topic, and my other interest, sorry to be a little bit self-promoting, but I just want to let you know what my areas of clinical interest and expertise are. They include thyroid and parathyroid disorders, laryngology for the adult and pediatric patient, including professional voice care, airway disorders when there's narrowing of the airway, the larynx and trachea. That's something that I see and take care of. And then also swallowing disorders, which I think are quite prevalent in the elderly. But today I want to focus on the neck and neck masses. And I think to do so, you really got to understand some of the different anatomic compartments of the neck, because once you have a knowledge of the different neck levels, and hopefully this is familiar to you because it's something that I think is taught in medical school. It's been a few years for me now. But again, this is really important to understand these different levels of the neck. And just to sort of point them out, there's six levels in the front of the neck, and then on the back side, the posterior neck, they're not part of the leveling system because, for the most part, things in the back of the neck tend to be more benign. But the levels in the front of the neck, there's six of them, and level one is broken up into 1A and 1B. One is defined as the anterior belly digastric, the hyoid bone, and the midline. Level 1B is the mandible, anterior belly digastric, and then the posterior belly digastric here. And this is called the submandibular triangle and submental triangle. Levels 2, 3, and 4 are basically the levels that run along the jugular vein. And so 2 is in the top, 3 middle, and the 4 on the bottom. Level 5 is the posterior neck triangle here. And it sometimes is divided into A and B, but for the most part, we just always referred to it as level 5. And then 6 is the central neck compartment, and that's where the thyroid lives. And we'll spend a pretty good amount of time talking about thyroid towards the end of the talk. Another way to categorize neck masses is not based on where the neck masses are, but on what type of things can develop there. And this includes inflammatory lesions or infectious, congenital masses, and then neoplastic, of course. And when we talk about inflammatory lesions, we can see things like reactive lymph nodes, which are very common, especially in younger adults. Sometimes infectious processes involve lymph nodes like tuberculosis. We'll spend a little bit of time talking about congenital lesions, which definitely occur in the neck, but are of these three different broad categories, probably the least common. And then neoplastic, unfortunately, is common and becomes more and more common as patients get older and older. And you can see things like lymphoma, squamous cell carcinoma that metastasizes to lymph nodes will often show up as a neck mass first. So a patient may have throat cancer, but the first presentation is the lymph node that metastasizes and shows up, presents as a neck mass. You can also have metastatic salivary gland cancers metastasizing to lymph nodes. Thyroid cancer can either present as a mass in the thyroid or a lymph node that is metastasized to other parts of the neck. And then sometimes cancers from the chest or abdomen come up into the neck, and that can also present as a neck mass. So from a primary care standpoint, when you first see a patient with a neck mass, there are different ways of approaching this, and it really depends on how acutely the neck mass is presenting. You know, if it's something that just showed up a week ago, maybe it's a little bit tender, more likely to be infectious, and then certainly antibiotics or just observation is reasonable. In younger patients or patients who have exposure to cats, sometimes it's worth checking for Bartonella-Henle titers because cat scratch disease can cause lymph node enlargement. But by and large, blood work is not one of the main things that we do or we feel is helpful in working up these patients. Rather, imaging is much more important, particularly if a neck mass has been present for more than just a few days or weeks. You know, when you're dealing with a 65-year-old former smoker or active smoker with a month or longer firm neck mass, that patient's going to need to be imaged. And there's different imaging modalities, and it can be a little confusing to remember which one is appropriate for which, and that's one of the goals of today is for me to help impart with on you which radiology studies are appropriate depending on what level we're dealing with. It's mostly dependent on the level. And then after imaging, probably the next most common thing is to get a tissue sample, and we'll talk about when is it better to do FNA versus open biopsy. And ultimately, sometimes patients need to be referred on to specialty care. And there's different specialties that are involved with neck masses. There's us, ENT, endocrine, mostly for thyroid, obviously. And then general surgery certainly is also, depending on the general surgeon, may be comfortable managing these as well. Hope you don't mind. I'm just going to throw in a few travel stories just to keep things interesting. And I, as was mentioned, I used to be in the military and was stationed overseas. And you can see the arrow right here. This is where my base was, RAF Lakenheath. And it was a lot of fun being over there. You know, it's one of those deals where they pay for everything. They'll package your trash and move it if you let them. And so when we were stationed there, I actually was living off base in a cute little village. Our house is shown in this picture here, 400 people, so a tiny little village. They used to have a number of commercial establishments, but nowadays, the only, or at least when we lived there, the only public establishment was the pub, which was just right down the road. So otherwise, it was just homes, and this was just a short walk, and so, you know, I might have been down there once or twice. This was the old bakery, which had been converted into a home, but that was a great experience. So let's now go ahead and talk about these different neck levels and what can commonly present in those areas and what to do about them. So the first area that I want to talk about is level 1A, which again is right under the chin or the submental area. And the different things that typically present here, probably the most common would be an enlarged lymph node. This is a common area for lymph nodes to be. You can also have things that are called plunging ranulas and thyroglossal duct cysts. We'll talk about those in a minute. But as far as lymph nodes, and you know, there's lymph nodes throughout the neck, and so what I'm going to say here about lymph nodes in the submental area really applies to lymph nodes throughout. And that is that CAT scan is, I think, the study of choice. MRI and ultrasound aren't bad for a lymph node enlargement, but CAT scan does the best job of comprehensively showing those, and they're really good at being able to measure them and further characterizing them. And when do we get worried about these? When do we feel like a biopsy is indicated? It mostly depends on the size. And there's really no like magic number beyond which we have to do a biopsy. Certainly, if it's just 1 centimeter, we're not going to be too worried about it. When it's 3 centimeters, it's clearly enlarged. But where you set that bar, it, you know, will depend on your own sort of comfort level and the patient's. But I generally say if it's over 2 centimeters, and it stays like that, it's going to need to be biopsied. And whether you do an FNA or an excisional biopsy, that again is a bit dependent on the different practitioner. But the problem with FNA is that a lot of times, if we're trying to rule out lymphoma, which is one of the more common reasons for lymph nodes to become enlarged, FNA doesn't give you enough tissue to do that. So very often, it's an excisional open biopsy to rule out something like lymphoma, which is tough because most of the time, even if you end up having to remove a lymph node, it's not going to be a lymphoma. So then you have to think about, you know, this person's going to have a scar on their neck forever, and is it really worth it? But you know, that's the call that we have to make sometimes. And as I mentioned, lymph nodes are either inflammatory or infectious. So let's move on and talk about plunging ranulas. These are not that common, and they're caused, this is a picture that shows what a plunging ranula looks like. And plunging ranula is a pseudocyst, so it's not a true cyst, but it's caused by a blockage of the sublingual gland, and the sublingual gland is shown right here. It's one of the saliva glands that's in the floor of the mouth, and when it gets blocked, the saliva that produces spills out into that space, and in some cases, it'll build up so much that it'll actually drop down into the neck, and that's why it's called plunging, and in that case, it can present as a neck mass. And this CAT scan shows how you can have the saliva building up in that pseudocyst here in the floor of mouth, and then here, a little lower down, you can see it dropping down into the neck.
And are all I've seen, these are CTs are without contrast, right? So, or like for the...
This is a non-contrast CT.
And the, for the slide before, too, you get a non-contrast CT. That one, for the enlargement.
Oh, well... I would say that you would want a contrast study in general in the neck, because
but not if it's thyroid.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, the reason thyroid is a problem is because the contrast gets absorbed by the thyroid tissue, and if it's cancer, it can delay radioactive iodine treatments. Although that concern is, I think, slightly overblown, because if you're dealing with a thyroid tumor and you do order a contrast CT and the patient goes to surgery, by the time they're ready for radioactive iodine, it's going to have been almost 2 months, and that contrast from the CT will have washed out by then. So it's good to be aware of that, but in general, I think that concern's a little bit overblown. And without contrast, the neck CT is much harder to read by a radiologist and by us, because you can't distinguish vessels from lymph nodes, and often they look very much the same unless you have contrast. Now let's talk about thyroglossal duct cysts. These are quite common, and even though it's a congenital lesion, and you think that a congenital lesion would show up early in the life of a person, surprisingly, sometimes these don't show up until people are in their 50s, 60s, or even later. And a thyroglossal duct cyst is a remnant of the thyroid as it descends embryologically from the tongue base into the lower neck. So embryologically, the thyroid starts here in the foramen cecum and then drops down into the neck, and usually it ends up here, and the track that it traveled down closes down, and that's it. But sometimes that track doesn't close down fully, and you have a small cyst that's left behind. Sometimes it's just filled with fluid, sometimes with thyroid tissue. And because there is this connection to the tongue, one way to, when you see a person with a mass in level one, if you ask them to stick out their tongue, if the mass elevates, then it most likely is a thyroglossal duct cyst. CT is really good for this, and we don't always have to remove these, but if a person is getting a lot of infections from them, which can occur, or if it's just visible and causing. Let's talk about level 1B next, and that's the submandibular triangle. In general, there's two things that we find in the submandibular triangle. One is problems with the submandibular gland itself, and then the other is lymph nodes, because there are a number of lymph nodes that reside in level 1B. This picture here shows a female with a submandibular gland mass or tumor. And the thing about submandibular gland tumors is that, unfortunately, about 50% of the time, they are malignant. And so we take these seriously. And whether you order a CT or MRI, they're both quite good for this. The nice thing about MRI is it's really good at distinguishing different soft tissues. And so if you have a tumor that's replacing or growing in the submandibular gland, you can see the normal part and the tumorous part. And for the most part, FNA is really good at telling us what is going on with a submandibular gland mass. It usually, just the tissue that you get through the needle is enough for the pathologist to make a call. And this picture here shows the submandibular gland right there. So another little story about England. We were stationed there for 3 years, and I don't know if you guys have seen this. This is called the London Eye, and it's something that was put up at the Millennium Celebration. So when the year 2000 rolled around, you know, a lot of places were doing big festivals and parties and things like that, and they thought it would be fun to put this up for that whole celebration. And I think it was funded by British Airways, and originally it was just going to be up there temporarily, and then they were going to take it down. Well, it's still there today. It's actually turned out to be the number one visited tourist attraction in England. It is pretty neat, because you enter, and they have these capsules right here, and about 30 people can fit into one of those. And the ride encompasses just one revolution. But once you get up top, this picture I took when I was near the top, you get a great view of the city. So it's become a bit of an icon and landmark. So let's talk about level 2 next. And just to remind you, level 2 is right up here, this purple, which is upper jugular chain. And one of the things that I think often is overlooked or can be confusing to people who aren't in our field is that the parotid gland can actually present with a mass in this level. Because normally you think of the parotid as up here in the cheek area, but the tail of the parotid, the lower part, actually drops down into the neck. And so quite often our patients are referred with a neck mass, and it turns out to be parotid. Other things that can...
Just when you finish.
Okay,
this
is
right. Thank you. So parotid masses can show up in level 2. So can enlarged lymph nodes. There's lots of lymph nodes along the jugular chain. And then branchial cleft anomalies, which are congenital lesions, are also fairly common, and we'll talk about those. So as I was mentioning, parotid masses can show up in the neck, and it's the tail of parotid. So this diagram shows the parotid gland, and obviously if there's a mass up here, it's not going to be confused as a neck mass. But down here, this part of the parotid is actually part of level 2. And here, this swelling right here is from the parotid, and you can see how close it is to the upper neck. Now, most parotid masses are benign, and so that's a good thing, but quite a few of them, the most common is a pleomorphic adenoma. They tend to grow bigger and bigger, and so we're usually recommending surgery for these. MRI is the study of choice, although CT is a close second, and FNA, fine needle aspiration, is really good at telling us what type of a lesion this is. And here, this is an MRI of a parotid lesion, so let me just show you what the parotid looks like on the normal side. I'm outlining the parotid gland right here. This is all parotid gland. This is, again, on the contralateral side where it's normal. And then on the side where there's a pleomorphic adenoma, which is the most common benign tumor involving parotid glands, is shown right here. You can see it's clearly delineated on this MRI. Now, branchial cleft anomalies are interesting, and you have to sort of go back to you know, remembering your embryology a little bit to understand how these develop. And as you can see from these pictures here of early development, when we're first developing, there are these branchial arches, and there's one, two, three, at least four, sometimes six branchial arches, and in between are these clefts and pouches. And when those don't resorb fully, then you can get a cyst or a sinus that becomes a branchial cleft anomaly. And so this patient here, you can see the bulge right here, it's level 2, and that's a branchial cleft anomaly. And these can present either as a cyst, sinus, or fistula. A cyst is an encapsulated pocket of fluid. The sinus will be opening either to the skin or to the inside of the throat. In some cases, but it's rare, you can have a complete through-and-through connection from the skin to the inside of the throat, and that would be a fistula. But most of the time, these are presenting as cysts. CT is really good, and I'll show you an example of a CT of a branchial cleft anomaly. These don't always have to be operated on, just like a thyroglossal duct cyst can sometimes just be followed. But if they are so big that they're cosmetically a problem, like this patient would probably not be happy to have this much of a bulge in her neck, or if they're becoming infected, then that's when we typically operate. So this is a CT that shows a branchial cleft anomaly, and these usually have a pretty distinct imaging characteristic in that they're, because it's a cystic structure filled with fluid, they have a homogeneous appearance, that the borders are well defined, and they're usually tucked in right behind the sternocleidomastoid muscle right there. Now moving down into the lower part of the neck, level 3 now, which is shown in green right there. Many lymph nodes are in this area, and we've already talked about how we manage lymph nodes. You can also have branchial cleft anomalies. The second branchial cleft anomaly is the most common, and these third and fourth branchial cleft anomalies, they're called third and fourth because they're caused by a failure of the spaces here, here, and here to resolve. And so these are a lot less common. And moving down into level 4, right here, that's in blue, again, lots of lymph nodes there, and the third and fourth branchial cleft anomalies can present there. I just want to spend a couple minutes talking about the third and fourth. They're grouped together because they pretty much behave the same. And you'll get a mass down in the level 3 or 4. Sometimes they can have an opening to the skin, which is shown in this diagram here. And then they wrap around like this, around these vessels, around the nerves. And we know how they should relate to all those structures based on the embryology of those structures. And then with the third or fourth branchial cleft anomaly, they often open up into the piriform sinus, which is in the lower throat. And also, they sometimes will track through the thyroid gland. And so in a patient who presents with a thyroid abscess, that's almost always going to be a third or fourth branchial cleft anomaly. And this CT shows that. We have a third or fourth branchial cleft anomaly. You can see part of it here. And then this is all thyroid here, and inside the thyroid is this cyst, and that's almost always going to be a Frankel-Kleft anomaly. It's rare, but not unheard of, and it's definitely good to be remember what that is, because I've seen a number of patients who had this, and it just wasn't recognized. People didn't put two and two together, and they were just treated with antibiotics and sort of passed on or had INDs now and then. But for this kind of case, if it's something that is causing symptoms, getting infected, then it's best to do surgery. And in this case, you'd have to remove that half that thyroid to completely get rid of the cyst and fix them. Now let's talk about level 5. And level 5, remember, is the posterior neck triangle. So it's bounded by the back of the sternocleidomastoid muscle here, the clavicle, and then the trapezius muscle. This area, there really aren't any glands. All it is lymph nodes. And it's quite common to have patients referred, often young adults, with a palpable lymph node, which may only be 1 or 1.5 centimeters in size. And it seems that this area of the neck, the lymph nodes are more easily felt and appreciated. And patients often are very concerned about lymph nodes, even though we may not be that concerned if they're only 1 or 1.5 centimeters in size. But also what's possible is that lymph nodes in that area are involved with cancer. And again, it can be cancer from the throat, such as squamous cell carcinoma of the thyroid, or metastasis from the lung or abdomen. This lower level 5, the supraclavicular area, is a common area for lung cancer, abdominal cancer to metastasize to. So another little travel story. I don't know if you guys have, I'm sure you've seen this icon in Moscow, St. Basil's Cathedral. You know, in the pictures, it looks much bigger than it actually is. And it's still, though, a really pretty landmark. And the thing that I found interesting when we visited there was that it was commissioned to be built about 500 years ago by the Tsar at the time. And he was obviously really happy with the outcome. You know, it's a beautiful structure. And his way of rewarding the architect was to have him blinded. He had his eyes gouged out because he didn't want the architect to go on and design a similar cathedral in another city. True story, yeah. Wow. Times are tough. Right? So let's talk about thyroid nodules. This is pretty much what we'll focus on for the remainder of the talk. And you know, thyroid nodules are very common, and they're more common in women than men. It's estimated that a palpable nodule that you can feel is present in 6% of all women. So again, that's quite common. Less so in men, only 1.5%. If you ultrasound or on autopsy look for thyroid nodules, it's estimated that they're present in as many as 50% of everybody. So that's an important thing to be aware of, especially when you're first seeing a patient, because a lot of these nodules now are picked up incidentally. You know, you'll order imaging because of cervical spine disease or something, and boom, there's a little thyroid nodule, and you break it to the patient, they're like, oh no, this is bad. But you know, most of these are benign, and so that's really important to kind of start the conversation like that. And this picture here is of a lady with a left thyroid nodule. So let's talk about the general risk of malignancy with thyroid nodules. If you take all comers, it's about 5%, but it is higher in young people. So if a 18-year-old walks in with a 4-centimeter thyroid nodule, they have a double the risk of malignancy, so more like 10%. In the elderly, the risk is also greater. And so if you see someone who's 75 and has a 4-centimeter thyroid nodule, their risk is going to be more like 20% that it's cancer. And then men, it's more common that their thyroid nodules are cancerous versus women. There are some other things that can give us a clue as to whether we should be more worried about a thyroid nodule, and things that would raise your concern for cancer would be if it's rapidly growing. I mean, if they've had this nodule for 20 years and hasn't changed, and obviously that's more likely to be benign. The bigger the nodule, the more likely it is to be cancerous. If they have a thyroid nodule and on the same side of their neck they have a 3-centimeter firm lymph node in level 5, that's going to be concerning. If they're also complaining of obstructive symptoms like trouble breathing and trouble swallowing. Or I just saw a 72-year-old last week who had 1 month history of significant hoarseness, really breathy voice, and her new papillary thyroid cancer, which hadn't been appreciated, had grown and invaded the nearby recurrent laryngeal nerve. And so hoarseness, significant hoarseness, along with the thyroid mass, that's concerning for cancer. There's also something called Pemberton's maneuver, and this gentleman here is doing it. And so if you have a big goiter that's going down into the chest, if you raise your arms, it puts compression at the thoracic inlet, and then this causes venous obstruction, and the patient, the face turns red like that. So maybe you can tell my name isn't the typical name, but I'm originally from Holland, and these are some pictures of tulip fields in Holland. One of the big exports in Holland is the tulip industry, and if you go in sort of late April, early May, that's the peak time to be there, and you get some awesome views like this. With the high prevalence of thyroid nodules, there's been task forces that have been convened by societies in endocrinology, which I think have really helped to standardize how we manage these, because over the years, things like thyroid scans have become, they used to be very popular to order for thyroid nodules, and now we're finding out they're really not that helpful. And so there was a meeting in 2006 and another one in 2009, and if you pull their references, they have a nice outline, guidelines, and I'm going to try to sort of distill some of that, because the latest version, 2009 guidelines, it is a huge thing. There's like 100 recommendations. It's a little overwhelming to look at it, but I'm going to try to just kind of focus on the highlights. So some of the things that this task force said is that thyroid nodules can be the cause of dysphagia, hoarseness, pressure, pain, and sometimes a thyroid nodule can be associated with overactive or underactive thyroids, but the absence of symptoms doesn't make it any less worrisome. They also stress the importance of reviewing risk factors, because some families have a strong history of thyroid cancer, and that would be important to know. And any patient who's had radiation, either for medical reasons or if they were near a nuclear plant accident, exposure to radiation is a big risk for thyroid cancer development. Some of the other things that the task force recommended that I think are really important to be aware of is that in the person who initially is found to have a palpable thyroid nodule or an incidentally found thyroid nodule on imaging, they should undergo a thyroid ultrasound, because ultrasound is the best way to image the thyroid in terms of seeing the nodules, measuring them. And the other thing is that you should order a blood test, but only TSH. So I think in the past people would order a full thyroid panel, and they found that that is not cost effective and really is not necessary. So just TSH and a thyroid ultrasound is how you begin. They also said that you shouldn't use a thyroid ultrasound as a screening tool, because if you do, you're going to find a lot of small nodules that are really of no consequence. When should the thyroid nodules be biopsied? The general rule now is that if it's 10 centimeters or bigger, then they should be. And if it's less than 10 centimeters, they typically aren't, unless there's something in the family history or the personal history that's really worrisome. And there are some ultrasound features like microcalcifications and internal vascularity that if are present in, let's say, an 8-millimeter thyroid nodule, that would warrant a biopsy. With children, the same goes. If the child has a 1-centimeter thyroid nodule, that should be biopsied. Pregnant patients, we typically would biopsy them even while they're pregnant, but if the biopsy showed cancer, oftentimes we'll wait until they're finished with their pregnancy, because these, for the most part, thyroid cancers tend to be slow growing and not that aggressive. So the only time that a thyroid scan, a radioisotope scan, is recommended of the thyroid is when the TSH is low, meaning that we're suspicious of a hyperthyroid patient. And as I mentioned, TSH is the best initial lab to assess thyroid function. When it is low, that's when we go ahead and order free T4 and a complete thyroid panel. And if it's high, if you suspect something like Hashimoto's or some form of hypothyroidism, then checking thyroid peroxidase antibody would be appropriate. In terms of referring these patients for further testing for FNAs, there's many options actually at this hospital and most hospitals, and that is that endocrinologists, not all of them, but many of them now are doing ultrasound, doing FNAs. Most radiology departments are doing it, and we, for about the past 2 years, are also doing biopsies. We've purchased an ultrasound machine. I've trained, one of my partners is trained in FNA, and so just something to be aware of. in our clinic, this is our procedure room where we do these FNAs. You can see our ultrasound machine here. Now, the more that I use this, the more I like it. I really find that ultrasound, not just for thyroid, but for other neck masses, is like an extension of your physical exam, and it just is a really great tool to have. But do you guys have ultrasound? Doing any? I know it just seems like across medicine, like anesthesia uses ultrasound more and more. The ER uses it to, you know, scan the abdomen. It just seems like in a lot of fields, ultrasound is becoming more and more prevalent. One of the things about our clinic, whether it's for thyroid or for any referral, we really try to see people quickly. And I found that, especially when you tell someone that they have a new mass anywhere in their body, they don't like to wait 2-3 months to have something done about it, to have a biopsy. And we really try to see people quickly. Within 2 weeks is our goal. Just to kind of give you a little bit of information on the technique, we try to anesthetize these patients as best as possible because it is it can be uncomfortable to have the needle placed in the neck, and if you don't anesthetize at all, they tend to not like it. And we exactly. I've heard of other places where they don't use it at all because, you know, they say, well, it's going to hurt just as much to numb it as doing a couple passes. But to really get an adequate specimen, you need to do 5 or 6 passes with the needle. And so because of that, I think it's worth anesthetizing not just the skin, but the tissue all the way down to the thyroid. And this just shows you how we line up the ultrasound transducer and the needle. You have to line it up so it's sort of in the same plane. And I'll show you some actual videos of the technique. So this is just an example of a big thyroid nodule. This is a 5-centimeter thyroid nodule. I'll play the video now. So just to kind of get oriented, the skin in this patient is up here, and then as we go further down on the screen, we're going deeper or more posterior in the neck. You can see the trachea right here. Some of the tracheal rings are showing up. A little bit of normal thyroid tissue is right here in the isthmus, which is the part of the thyroid that's connecting the two lobes. And then all of this is abnormal. All of this is a nodule. Let me just play the video more. One thing about ultrasound is when you're actually doing it yourself, you get a lot more information. It's hard to sometimes watch the video after it's been done, but I think you'll be able to see pretty clearly here. This is the needle coming in. So again, the skin's up here, so you're always going to see the needle come from the top down at an angle. And the great thing about ultrasound guided fineal aspiration is if it's done correctly and you can see the tip of the needle, there's just no doubt that you're in the right place. Whereas, you know, 10, 20 years ago, a lot of these masses, if you could at least feel them, you would do the fine needle aspiration without image guidance. And oftentimes you would get in the right spot, but here there's just no doubt. It's much more precise. This same patient also had a nearby lymph node that looked a little suspicious. And let me just play that video. So you can just make out the top of that big thyroid nodule. This is the carotid artery. This is the jugular vein. And here is that about 1-centimeter nodule, which maybe wouldn't have been biopsied except that he had this huge thyroid nodule nearby. And so in this case, I elected to also biopsy that. You can see the needle coming in like this. The tip of the needle is here. This, you could never do this without ultrasound guidance. And you can see that you'd want to know where that needle is because that's the carotid artery. But with ultrasound, you can see the tip, where it is, and it can be done in a safe, effective manner. Again, a little Holland pictures. So, you know, a lot of Holland is below sea level, And the way that the flooding is prevented is they have a big, extensive dike system. And in the old days, they didn't have electrical pumps. They would rely on wind power to pump the water from the lowest levels up sequentially higher and then back out to sea. And so you still see a lot of the windmills. Now they're mostly just for decoration and tourism. But that's what the original purpose of these windmills was. And then this is a picture of Amsterdam, which has got a lot of canals in them. And these were designed and built, you know, in the 1600s, back in the heyday when Holland was a big trading power, and ships would come from all over the world with goods that they had bought. And it's a good place to visit. I want to wrap up by talking about the back of the neck. Remember I said that on the back of the neck, you can develop masses there, but they tend to not be that serious. The two most common things that I see referred to us are lipomas. And this gentleman here has a lipoma of the back of the neck. And that's just a benign fatty growth. And sometimes patients do want them removed, especially if it's a gentleman who has to wear a tie. You know, it kind of gets in the way. And but they don't have to be removed. They tend to be benign. The other thing that we can see is epidermal inclusion cysts, which can form anywhere in the body. But this picture here shows an epidermal inclusion cyst. They're very close to the skin. As you can see, this CAT scan is of an epidermal inclusion cyst. And it's just right below the skin. And certainly something like that we would remove, but we could do that in the clinic under local anesthesia. Hopefully you never see something like this. This is a hibernoma. I've never seen this, but just Googling neck masses, this came up. It's a rare benign soft tissue tumor arising from the vestigial remnants of so-called brown fat. And here it is on scan. Hard to hide that, right? Just to wrap up, you know, neck masses can be either inflammatory, congenital, or neoplastic. I think overall CT is the most popular imaging modality, but certainly for thyroid, it's ultrasound. And when we're talking about parotid or submandibular lesions, MRI is quite good. And we'd certainly be happy to see any patients that you guys have that present with these types of neck masses. Any questions?
I just have one question. I'm sorry, I was a little late. In terms of physical exam findings and time to diagnosis, I know that in a lot of the breast cancer literature, nodules are actually identified by patients more than providers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I mean, I think about my thyroid exam and how much I'm just rooting around sometimes and how it's not necessarily something that we're all excellent at.
Mm-hmm.
How is that what you're seeing, or providers identifying these nodules, patients? What's the...
In my experience, it's usually the primary care provider that's picking up neck masses, including thyroid, way before the patient does. It's surprising to me, really surprising, that you can have a really firm 3-centimeter nodule that the patient will just kind of like, you know, wow, I didn't even notice that. Yeah, so I think, please keep checking, because very often you're the one that sees it or feels it first.
We used to do some of these at home 30 years ago. We'd just take a needle out and stick it into a lymph node, squirt it on a slide, spray it with PAP fixative, and bring it back as it was faster. If you do that anymore, how do you process the tissue these days?
For a fine needle aspiration?
Yeah.
The tissue, more and more, the pathologists, cytopathologists, don't want it on slides. They want it in this pink cytolite solution, which is then spun down, and they can take different layers, and that's pretty much what we do. We would love it if they were on site with us when we're doing the aspiration, so they could immediately process it and let us know, you know, you got a good sample, or actually it's a bit hypocellular and keep going for more, but they just don't have the manpower to do that. So typically put it in the little pink solution, do 5 or 6 passes, and then hope that we got a good specimen.
What number do we call to make an appointment for you to see one of our patients?
Our main number is 638-8124.
Thank you.
But we also, and I think I showed in the slide, Samaya James is one of our referral coordinators. And let's get back to her. Yeah, Samaya James. She's on Outlook, and I don't know her number off the top of my head, but I can certainly email it to.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But she's very responsive.
What is it about the composition of these subtypes of masses, the thyroid, parathyroid, and the which makes different imaging modalities, you know, better for them?
Mm.
You know, is this about the constitution of the masses themselves, or about the associated diseases that you can find that are related to them that makes you prefer one modality over the other?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know why thyroid. You would think that CT and MRI, which are really pretty good for everything else, they're well, not terrible, but they're just not as good for the thyroid as ultrasound. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it has to do with the way the tissue is, you know, constructed at a cellular level, and the way that it images, and it just images beautifully on ultrasound. And so, but I don't know much more than that.
Not so crazy a question. Is there any ongoing collaboration between endocrine and ENT when you suspect something's in the thyroid?
Yeah, we definitely, I feel like we have a great relationship with endocrine, and there's also general surgery that does a lot of endocrine surgery, Dave McEnany, Jennifer Rosen. We just this week had a meeting where we discussed surgical cases, which we're going to try to do on an ongoing basis. It's definitely, when you talk about a patient with thyroid cancer, it's much better patient care if the surgeon and the endocrinologist and the primary care doctor are all working together. And we got a really good endocrine group here. Luckily, they've added some more people, so their wait times are getting better. When I first started here, it was tough. I would want to send them a patient with a thyroid nodule for biopsy, and I'd hear sometimes 2 to 3 months before an appointment, which is better now because they've added some people. But again, as I was saying, it's a hard sell on a patient to tell them that they have to wait that long.
I'm pretty sure they have, Stephanie said they have a neck mass clinic too. Like if you see a patient that has a neck mass and you want endocrine, you can call and say, "I need this person seen in
the neck
mass, and
they can
help get it quickly."
You're right.
The same thing as you guys, I think. Yeah, I do think it's gotten.
It's up to you guys, and I'm certainly not trying to undercut them. I value their relationship a lot, and we work together on many patients. But for me, the ultrasound it's been really helpful for me, also in surgical planning. But, you know, we also can do the FNA.